This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Governor Sununu picks a former rival to lead New Hampshire's Department of Education and says he wants to approve any new state hiring. The GOP-led state Senate makes quick work on some party priorities. The Department of Justice reaches a multi-million dollar settlement with a pharmaceutical company pushing fentanyl to doctors in New Hampshire. Kelly Ayotte lands at Harvard for the spring term, and at noon it will be President Donald Trump. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Again, I'm Josh Rogers. Joining us this week is NHPR's Casey McDermott, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Busy week. In the busy week in Washington, obviously busy week in Concord. Why don't we start with Governor Sununu and some of his moves? Why don't we start with Commissioner of Education nominee Frank Edelblu? The big picture is that Edelblu is a huge school choice advocate, homeschooled seven children. Casey, you did some reporting on his educational stances during the governor's race. What are some of the details there?
Yeah, he is not a fan of Common Core. I think that's kind of the main thing to emphasize. He is a big fan of kind of so-called school choice, charter schools. And above all, I would say that this was reflected definitely in his legislative record in terms of the bills that he filed during his short time in the legislature before running for governor, but also just in what you heard him talk about on the campaign trail. Big, big proponent of leaving the choice and control of students' education in the hands of parents. So whether that comes to curriculum, whether that comes to where they send their kids to school, I think that he's definitely someone who is, going to be cheered by a lot of people who feel like parental control and parental choice is paramount in terms of education.
And also somebody who was clearly quite comfortable with doing things differently. Why don't we listen to something he said on the campaign trail about education and how he believes its priorities have become upended?
Today in education, we've got a fixed component and we've got a variable component. And let's take high school as an example. On the fixed side, you've got 4 years, 180 days a year. The variable component is, did you learn anything? A, B, C, D, F. These things are completely reversed. What we really need to do is, the variable is the amount of time that you spend in education. The fixed is, did you acquire the information and the skills you need to be able to get out of high school and engage society and the culture?
All right, that's Frank Edelblu, former gubernatorial candidate, Governor Chris Sununu's pick for education commissioner. Dean, what did you hear in that tape that is emblematic of his approach?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Should he be confirmed?
Sure, and there are some interesting parallels between the discussion going on at the state level with him as the nominee for education and what's going on at the federal level with the new nominee for the Department of Education, Betsy DeVos, and we'll talk a little bit later about Senator Hassan's questioning of her. This is interesting. This represents a real shift in direction for the department. As Casey was saying, Mr. Edelblu is much more in line with traditional Republican and conservative thinking on education. He's talked a little bit recently about a need to focus on students more individually. I'm interested to see what that means in a public school context. The biggest concern for opponents is that people who support this idea of vouchers and charter schools, et cetera, that it's essentially a way to kind of drain resources from public education. So, the Common Core issue we've discussed before, that's a change from the current education commissioner here in New Hampshire, Barry. So it's just going to be a different approach. He homeschooled his kids, has a very different view of kind of the role of public education, seems pretty eager for the job. Just to backtrack a little bit politically, we know he lost in the primary by only 800 votes to Governor Sununu, and he very quickly endorsed him, which set him quite nicely for this particular appointment.
I mean, it was an interesting pick. Mr. Edelblu, as his critics have been wont to point out, has no formal background in education, having worked in a school. Obviously, homeschooling seven kids would be a chore. He holds a master's in theology. He was a former board member of Patrick Henry College, which bills itself as a classical Christian liberal arts college where it espouses a biblical worldview. He's also a businessman who sold a company that dealt with sort of back-end compliance issues for businesses and, you know, says he sees his job as a big part of this job is boosting workforce. You know, David, you were at the council meeting. Obviously, went over well with the Republicans there.
Frank is obviously very popular. He came very close to winning the nomination. And aside from the policy differences, he'll bring a very different personality to the position of Commissioner of Education. He calls himself the implementer. He is going to be front and center on a lot of these issues in the media and before the legislature, and will have the ear of the governor and be very active in the policy arena. I think to an extent that his predecessor, Virginia Berry, was not, who was largely a technocrat, who operated largely behind the scenes.
Well, also someone who's very much in step with essentially Obama-era education
right.
policy. You know, we don't quite know what we're going to get from the Trump administration on this front, but certainly Edelblue said from the beginning is that he's somebody who believes that it's about local control and that and there's some irony, obviously, in his in having a job being the commissioner of education. But he says he said to our reporter, Jason Moon, when he talked to him, that he sees his role as helping local districts, you know, become what they want and helping each child reach their.
Yeah. And there really are philosophical similarities. If you've listened to any of the confirmation hearing for Trump's nominee, same kind of philosophy about returning to local control, using state resources, not just for public education, but to give people other options like vouchers or other sorts of charter schools. You know, one interesting example is Governor Sununu talked about full day kindergarten. When he ran for office, Frank Edelblue has said that he doesn't necessarily think that that's a great idea. That'll be one area it'll be interesting to see if he comes around.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Frank Edelblue will get a public hearing and, you know, we'll seemingly have the votes to be the next state education commissioner. You know, another appointment that Governor Sununu moved on, less high profile, was that of the state fire marshal, Bill Degnan, who's been in holdover since March. Someone who's held that job for 10 years, decades in the firefighting community. Sort of interesting backstory politically on what happened with Mr. Degnan, David.
Yeah, this falls into that category of one of those partisan issues that comes up in the late term of governor that is sort of left unresolved pending the upcoming election, much in the way of the Supreme Court appointment for at the national level. This appointment has been sitting before the Executive Council since March. In and of itself, it's not one of really huge implications for everyday residents of New Hampshire, but it matters a lot to the firefighters in the state. And the appointment of Mr. Degnan became a flashpoint for the separation that exists or appears to exist in the interest of the professional firefighters, the full-time firefighters in the larger cities and towns in the state. Who are unionized under the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire. They represent about 60% of the population. They protect about 60% of the population, as they say. And the very different small-town volunteer departments and their chiefs, who were very much aligned with the incumbent fire marshal, the professionals felt he was not up to modern standards. He was paying too much attention to the needs of training and community outreach and the investigations that the smaller departments need, not paying enough attention to issues like the impact of flame retardants on water pollution, the opioid crisis, and the newer firefighting technology. This rift came to the Executive Council in the form of this appointment that just languished. The governor did not want to bring forward another nomination, but she did not want to antagonize the professional firefighters either because
she said essentially saying she supported Bill Degnan but
never brought it forward, so it just sat there.
You know, and the political backdrop is that the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire, big backers of Governor Hassan, now Senator Hassan, right. Big source of money, source of you know, campaign ground organization, and you know, I guess you know, do we have any reason to believe that anything else was affecting Governor Hassan's decision to sort of sit on
She always said it was a very strange situation, very frustrating to Councilor Joe Kenney on the Executive Council and others who supported Degnan. She said, I support the fire chief, the fire marshal. I'm not bringing any other candidate forward, but neither did she bring his forward. I think they were waiting for the outcome of the election. If Colin Van Ostrand hadn't been elected, the outcome might have been different for Mr. Degnan.
All right. Tell us what you think on Chris Sununu's appointments and anything else in the news this week. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Joined this week by Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader Casey McDermott, NHPR, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. You know, Chris Sununu had a first press conference this week, said that he wants to have a say-so on state hiring, but says it was something short of a freeze. You know, what do you make of that there? Jockeying on the budget, legitimate concern over, say, fiscal situation, a little bit of both?
Yeah, probably a little bit of both. You know, this is not surprising to me. You know, there's one way that chief executives, whether it's a president or a governor, can exert control over the process is to basically set up, you know, either a regulatory or a hiring or a purchasing bottleneck in which they kind of get to review up close what is going on. So so this is not actually, in his words, a hiring freeze, but he wants hiring purchases, and they're also doing a review of regulations to pass through the governor's office, which is really kind of a way to exert, you know, your preferences on whatever it is that's happening. I mean, this has been going on at the presidential level for many years. They typically do it through the Office of Management and Budget. Same kind of idea. It's interesting. You know, I had an opportunity to interview Governor Sununu as part of our Pints and Politics series, and you can find a link to that interview at NH Political Capital. He talked a lot about how this issue of, you know, how much of a surplus is there going to be, the problems with overruns at Health and Human Services. You know, in his mind is that a lot of this can really be sort of fixed with, you know, sort of rethinking regulation and efficiencies, you know, sort of bureaucratic reform. We shall see. But you know, we've talked about this before. It's to some extent, it's kind of in his interest to kind of downplay a little bit the surpluses, again, as a means of kind of a more closely exerting his preferences.
Well, I mean, he says revenues are, you know, above targets,
right,
but the caseload issues at Health Human Services,
right,
$65 million hole, apparently.
Exactly.
And, you know, projecting caseloads is a little tricky, and
right,
given the state's low unemployment rate and the general health of the economy, they were perhaps more optimistic than reality is bearing out to be. But, you know, Governor Sununu has said that he's not sure the surplus that you know, Governor Hassan's administration was touting ever existed. And, you know, I guess we'll see when they close the books. But I think this is a sign that, you know, budget jockeying, you know, is well underway.
Some of the surplus has already been claimed for off-budget spending, like the dairy farmers bailout, $3 to $4 million, the cost of converting from Concord steam to natural gas.
That could be very costly.
It's going to be very costly. Then, of course, the $65 million deficit that will occur is projected to occur in the Department of Health and Human Services by June 30th unless something is done between now and then. So the action on hiring is, of course, a part of Sununu demonstrating he is going to be an under-the-hood governor, but it's also viewed as a part of a strategy now underway in the legislature where the leading lawmakers and the governor have basically said to the director of Health and Human Services, we're going to figure out how to deal with the $65 million problem, and it's not going to be writing you a $65 million check. So they're looking for cuts.
Yeah, well, the regulatory bit of this about, you know, a 90-day review of rules, which is something that hasn't gotten a great deal of attention, but which is something that, you know, remains interesting to me. I've talked to several people within state agencies and gotten kind of very divergent views about the implications of this, some being like, oh, you know, we'll be fine. Others suggesting that, you know, a retrospective look at every regulation, its provenance, and whether or not one has the authority to is under a mandate to enforce it, you know, could be a lot of work.
A lot of the department's heads have said the time allotted for the review of all these regulations is just unrealistic, to which the governor has responded, well, that suggests then that we have too many regulations. So he's clearly made it an ideological as well as a practical proposition for the state.
Well, one perennial bit of budget jockeying that takes place is over UNH tuition, and UNH officials were before budget writers this week. They said essentially, give us a little more, we'll freeze tuition. Casey, what's the status there?
So they're saying that basically, regardless of what they get, this is their pledge to the legislature, at least right now, that they will increase tuition no more than 2.5% over the next 2 years. But they're saying, listen, if you guys can give us a little bit more money, we promise to freeze it altogether for the next 2 years at least. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. I know my understanding just from kind of following this a little bit more at a distance, is that there is some frustration among the legislature at the university system, particularly when you see things like, the purchase of $1 million scoreboard or other kind
that
of things
infamous
that
table
are seen.
That was kind of interactive. Yeah. I forget what it cost, but it was quite expensive.
It was very expensive. So to balance that with this plea for more money, and I think you're going to see a lot of grilling from lawmakers to university officials about, okay, can you show us that you're actually using the money that we have given you wisely, or can you make other concessions or accommodations within your budget to offset the cost for students? And it is worth noting that if you do look at the price of tuition for the University of New Hampshire, for example, it's a public school, but it's definitely not cheap for in-state students as it is now.
Well, the state contribution is obviously famously low, but it is interesting with a Republican in there, and you look at some of the people working for Chris Sununu. You have former House Majority Leader DJ Betancourt in there as a policy advisor. Under his watch in the O'Brien legislature, there's obviously lots of scrutiny about whether there was administrative bloat at the university system and, a big budget cut. And so that's going to be interesting to watch. And it does seem that strategically UNH is trying to kind of get in early and, try to strike some sort of understanding.
Well, strategically, they're also trying to leverage the interest of the business community and workforce development, a strong political thread in the state right now. The BIA has essentially endorsed the university system's request for a 12.5% increase, amounting to about $20 million more dollars than the previous budget, on the promise of scholarships for the top-performing students to keep them here, and scholarships for students going into science, technology, engineering, and math. So the university system is hoping that this is the right time, with a relatively strong fiscal condition of the state and the workforce development issues front and center and the support of the business community behind their budget request, that they can finally get back to close to what the funding levels were prior to the O'Brien budget cuts in 2011.
It's interesting listening to the conversation here and also thinking about my earlier conversation with Governor Sununu. This is what we're seeing emerging as kind of a very traditional Republican approach focused on reforming bureaucracies. So Sununu was very clear that the issue here is not insufficient resources. It's how the resources are used and whether or not they're used efficiently. And he believes that if they set up these kinds of checkpoints in the executive office to sort of look at regs and look at hiring and look at how money is being spent, that they can have a balanced budget. Bureaucracies have a tendency to grind down their leaders over time. They're very resistant to change. So this is going to be an interesting challenge to see if he can pull it off.
Tell us what you think. The number is 1-888-1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. What are you hoping for out of a Sununu budget, which we'll be getting, relatively soon, just a few weeks? And what do you want lawmakers to focus on in Concord? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is the Weekly News Roundup on NHPR. Be back in a minute. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org and at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this week by Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, Dave Solomon, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Casey McDermott, NHPR. And, you know, we're talking a lot about things that will and may happen. There have some things that actually are starting to literally happen at the legislature. The state Senate had a real calendar this week and acted fast on bills we've talked about here, Republican priorities of right to work and concealed carry. They slid through as advertised. Did we learn anything new during this, David?
A lot of the same themes that have been repeated over the years as both of these bills have come up several times. I don't think there was anything fresh in any of the arguments that were made. You know, as they say, to the victor go the spoils. And given the scope of the Republican victory, it seems like they're very anxious to claim the spoils, which is successful promotion of several policy initiatives that they've tried unsuccessfully in the past, and to come right out of the gate with right to work and concealed carry of firearms without a permit suggests that they're going straight for the some of the things at the top of the ideological checklist, and they think they have the votes to get it through. The Senate debate yesterday, in what is ordinarily a very cordial atmosphere, turned a little tense at times as some of the Democratic senators accused their Republican counterparts of basically going through the motions of hearings for what was a predetermined outcome, especially on right to work, where pages and pages of testimony were submitted to the committee that voted immediately after the hearing was closed to recommend passage, meaning a lot of the testimony wasn't even taken into consideration.
I mean, complaints about process are typically those that the minority party in a legislature specializes in. But, you know, one thing about the right to work debate that I do find interesting is that the degree to which people are promoting it as the single most important economic development tool in the toolbox is something we heard repeatedly. Senator Andy Sanborn on the floor said, this will bring more jobs. This will, it's not, there's no conditional, it may, it could. There's lots of definitive statements that it will. And whether to attribute this to the push over time of, you know, advocacy groups like Americans for Prosperity, who have made this more of a mainstream issue. The Business and Industry Association is foursquare behind this. The fact that it doesn't really cost any money, you know, might roll into that. But, I mean, are you hearing anything different about this, Casey?
I'm not personally. And I do think I would just put a plug in. My colleague Todd Bookman has a really thorough explainer on our website, nhpr.org, right now that actually kind of breaks down the amount of people who are in a union right now in New Hampshire, kind of puts into context the number of people who could potentially be affected by this. It has seemed very, on both sides, like pretty hypothetical, the discussions. I don't think we've heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, any specific companies that have said, I'm going to move to New Hampshire if you become a right to work state, or that have said, I haven't come to New Hampshire because you're not a right to work state. And I think it's also just in terms of the number of people who are going to be affected.
Right
now, you know, union membership in New Hampshire has remained relatively constant over time and has been a relatively small portion of the overall number of people who are working here. So as of 2015, there were only about 62,000 people who were members of a union in New Hampshire's workforce, compared to 578,000 who were not a member of a union in the workforce. So in terms of the people who are actually going to be affected by this, it's a relatively small proportion.
Yeah, this is one of those issues that has the feel of a national issue that has kind of been very ideologically polarizing. It's now trickled down to the state level. The arguments in favor and against have kind of hardened. You know, in some sense, it feels a little bit like the casino debate that we've had for many years, where I sort of know what the arguments are and you kind of know where each side is on this. And, you know, it looks like it's going to go through and the governor will sign it. And then we will see whether it turns out to be what Republicans are promising that it will be.
You know, David mentioned that, you know, essentially to the victors go the spoils in terms of being able to get your policy priorities through if you're Republicans. You know, listening to Democrats yesterday, you know, several of them made the argument that, you know, this really isn't what the people want. This really isn't what's going to address the most pressing economic problems in the state, which are things like electricity rates, workforce development and training. Obviously, those problems are harder to solve than passing a bill that you hope will induce manufacturers to get here.
Yeah, well, this is in that category of low-hanging fruit that the governor alluded to. At the time, he was talking about nonpartisan issues that they could build a coalition around, but this is a highly partisan issue that's also low-hanging fruit because it's very easy to pass and say you're doing something in terms of economic development, whereas, as you point out, the real issues for the business community, whether they're businesses that are in the state and would like to expand or businesses considering coming here, is by far electricity, energy prices, and availability of a skilled workforce. Right to work pales. It's very small compared to those issues. But those two issues cannot be addressed by passing one piece of legislation, as was done yesterday with Right to Work.
All right. Why don't we go to the phone? Steve is on the line from Portsmouth. Good morning, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yep. Why don't you speak up a little?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, two questions. One is with Edelblum. Given his Christian background and homeschooling, do we know is he a creationist? Do we know if he has that philosophy and that will come to have any influence in his tenure as
All right.
of office?
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. What we know is that his resume lists, board member at Patrick Henry College, which does espouse a biblical worldview. Casey, was this question asked him on the campaign trail? I don't recall.
Not that I can recall. And I wouldn't want to speculate without asking him in terms of his views or how that would influence his approach to education. So I don't remember it coming up in the gubernatorial campaign.
Yes. I mean, he did run as the kind of conservative in the race, and he did a good job of kind of locating himself in the sort of nexus of a Venn diagram of various sort of conservative groups, be they homeschoolers, evangelical Christians, gun owners. He sort of found himself in the middle of a coalition and really, did surprise people and almost, defeated the man who's now wants him to be Commissioner of Education in the primary. Thanks for the call. Dan is on the line from Durham. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. I noticed there's never much discussion in talking about right to work laws about the other 28 states that have already passed it. There must be data out there about whether it does or does not create jobs.
There's lots of competing data. We've all been treated to recitations of those. David, you've sat through these hearings.
Both sides use the state of Indiana, which produced statistical material that could be used to support either argument. On the one hand, after passing Right to Know, the state did experience job growth. Was that attributable to Right to Know passage or a general growth in
right
the economy?
To work. Well, and people like, critics of Right to Work often say that states that have it actually have lower wages. There are other factors at play.
Right. Then the Democrats
like
use the fact that average wage is lower and unemployment is higher in Indiana than it is here. So there are statistics, actually, that are used by both sides. The statistics will never resolve this argument conclusively.
And I think it would be just worth, and obviously this goes with most any study that you're looking at, but be mindful of the source that you're getting the statistics from, because, there are a lot of interest groups on both sides of this that will, pick and choose various numbers to support their argument.
It's typical of these kinds of national debates that, by the time it gets to where we are now here in New Hampshire, everybody's got their data supporting their point of view. Again, as I mentioned earlier, it reminds me of the casino debate where, both sides had their evidence showing what the benefits and downsides were to the opposition's argument. So, it's not surprising to me that there are lots of studies on both sides and that that's not going to be conclusive.
All right. We'll leave Right to Work there for the moment. Want to touch briefly on the action in the Senate on concealed carry. That was perhaps even less surprising than Right to Work, given that it has passed several times before, that it is something that Chris Sununu said he was in favor of. It seems like if all things go according to past votes, New Hampshire will join its northern New England neighbors in not requiring permits for carried concealed weapons. Again, are these issues that, you know, these are things that Republicans want, these are things that Democrats say Republicans didn't really articulate on the campaign trail?
This was interesting because the law enforcement lobby in the State House usually gets its way. They have lost on this one, and they didn't even send anyone to testify at the Senate hearing. I think they were so sure that the cause was lost. They did provide written statement of their continued opposition, but I think there's such a strong ideological push for this, even though it isn't one of the big priorities among the electorate at large, that it will become law. Given the New Hampshire's political bipolar nature, several years down the road, if there's a Democratic majority, it'll probably be revoked.
I think what we're seeing now that's kind of interesting, having watched the arc of Chris Sununu's campaign, at least from, you know, the summer, whenever things were kind of ramping up onward, from the beginning, I think he said as much that he was running a general election campaign. So the Chris Sununu that we saw on the campaign trail was a moderate, and he got a lot of flack for that during the Republican primary. Alienated a lot of conservatives. The margin between him and now DOE nominee Frank Edelblut was the closest primary margin that we've seen for a Republican primary since his father ran in the 1980s. So I think that part of what we're seeing now is Sununu making a number of gestures to kind of win back or earn more trust among the more conservative parts of his party that he may have turned off earlier in the campaign.
And it may be a way to generate political capital. So, you know, give the core, you know, these core issues to partisans, and then maybe make some deals on other issues down the road.
Well, these two issues are relatively fast work. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. You can potentially, we'll see what happens with the right to work in the House, but they're bills you can move quickly. They're kind of chits that can pile up.
Right.
The tougher
the capital,
work will be with the budget. And we have an email on that from Mark in Manchester. And he says, if they truly care about the children, the legislature will address the serious problem of future unfunded liabilities in state pensions. And don't subsidize UNH, he adds. Let them survive on their own merits. If they're going to spend $1 million on a big screen TV and $100,000 on a dining table, they don't need subsidies from us taxpayers.
The table was $17,000 or something, but
I think that
it's the urban legend that
it's still expensive.
But no, I think there's a lot. I mean, having been a college student not too long ago, I think that there's definitely legitimate questions to be asked about how those schools are using money and balancing their budgets at the expense of students. So,
all right, thank you. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is appreciated at exchange@nhpr.org. You know, we've been talking about the Senate, and the Senate is smaller numbers, kind of easier to get the herd on its feet. The House action will really kick into their gear when the budget arrives. But, you know, the House is hearing some bills that are drawing some attention. David, you covered one this week about a proposal to change standards in sexual assault cases. That certainly brought out a crowd. What was the debate there?
This was a change in legislation calling for corroborating evidence in sexual assault cases that are brought forward against a potential defendant who has no prior conviction. And it came about over the concern of a psychologist in Concord who was convicted of sexual assaulting a young male patient solely on the testimony of that patient, as is common in sexual assault cases, because there often is not corroborating evidence or third-party witnesses, and there's just a huge groundswell of concern for this individual that brought forward this legislation. And the proponents of the legislation acknowledged that it was being brought about because of the situation and the verdict against this psychologist. And opponents said you should not be making legislation on the basis of a single case, and that the jury system by which 12 men and women, your peers, have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt as to the credibility of that witness should be sufficient for due process. That point of view will likely prevail, but it remains to be seen.
Yes. The bill really sort of brought together a lot of criticism. And, the House, obviously in the legislature, anyone can sponsor a bill. Some of these more kind of out there things tend to come out of the House. And the House Criminal Justice Committee is home to many a colorful hearing. Why don't we move away from the legislature for a minute and talk about a settlement announced by the Attorney General this week with Incest, an Arizona drug company. The settlement was for $3.4 million. About three of that will go to New Hampshire. $500,000 will go to the Charitable Foundation. It was over a fentanyl spray. Casey, basically what happened there?
Yeah, so this is part of Attorney General Joe Foster's kind of crusade to go after drug companies over potentially, you know, misleading marketing practices or overselling various opioids. And, you know, the kind of undercurrent of that is to look at drug companies' role in proliferating the opioid crisis here in New Hampshire. So this is actually one of several lawsuits that this company was facing from states. I believe there was another one underway in Illinois. But basically, in this case, they have, you know, determined that the company wrongfully marketed the opioid painkiller in New Hampshire.
Well, the drug, I mean, I think the drug was made for what's known as breakthrough pain, right? Severe pain, and this was for being cancer, prescribed, yeah, for a chronic pain. And it seems that the company is a pattern of finding, you know, high prescribers, mm-hmm, and, you know, inducing them either by, you know, what the AG called the sort of sham speaking fees. One thing that was interesting about this case was that the big prescriber in New Hampshire was a fellow, Chris Clough, a former physician's assistant at Pain Care, the chain out of Somersworth. His privileges were pulled by the state for prescribing practice, among other things. But he was, you know, prescribing a lot of this drug and
part of their speakers bureau.
Part of their speakers bureau, and they said that, yes, these speeches are often sham events, parties. According to the Attorney General's office, receptions where it would be his family and members, yeah, of the Pain Care staff. It does seem that this company is sort of on the more, you know, kind of buccaneering end of the spectrum in terms of drug. They've paid, yeah, settlements out in Oregon. As Casey said, there's legal action underfoot elsewhere. I mean,
there's also legal action against other companies right now in New Hampshire.
Well, that's the more interesting thing, is where this goes. I believe there's going to be a hearing before the Supreme Court that will be sort of a procedural one about whether or not the state can hire this outside firm to go after them. But it's interesting because this, to use a term that's come up earlier, this may be sort of a low-hanging fruit. The other companies, it'll be interesting to see what comes out. This was a company that actually complied with the subpoenas, and this is what we got out of it. The Attorney General's office hopes this is essentially a shot across the bow. One thing that's going to be interesting when there's a changing of the guard at the Department of Justice is how aggressively does this effort persist under the Sununu administration?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, fentanyl has turned out to be a real driver in the spike in opioid deaths. You know, the initial focus was on heroin, and then it became clear very quickly that a lot of these deaths are actually heroin mixed with fentanyl or just fentanyl. So it's something that I think the state is eager to crack down on.
All right, and that Supreme Court hearing, I believe, will be next month. Give us a call. Tell us what you think of the week's news, what you're hoping for out of Washington, which is where we're going to shift our focus after the break. Again, the number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is always welcome at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Stick around. We'll be back after a short break. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org and at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. All right, it's, you know, in a matter of hours, it's going to be President Trump. Obviously, his picks to staff his cabinet have been front and center for the past couple of weeks, as has New Hampshire senators questioning them. You know, former Governor Maggie Hassan, now Senator Hassan, sort of got into a real back and forth with Trump's pick for Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Why don't we take a listen to that?
Senator, I assure you that if confirmed, I will be very sensitive to the needs of special needs students and the policies surrounding that.
And with all due respect, it's not about sensitivity, although that helps. It's about being willing to enforce the law to make sure that my child and every child has the same access to public education, high-quality public education.
All right, that was Senator Maggie Hassan questioning Trump nominee Betsy DeVos on Tuesday on her commitment to the rights of students with disabilities. Obviously, Senator Hassan, her son Ben, who has cerebral palsy, is a big part of her life. She's also made it a big part of her political story through the years, hasn't she, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, watching this hearing, and we talked last week about her earlier questioning of General Kelly for Homeland Security, and she had mentioned that bogus Washington Post story. This time, she was on very firm ground. She knows this stuff inside and out from her own personal experience. And the discussion we heard was about the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a federal law to ensure that all students have access to public education. And her concern was, Betsy DeVos, much like Frank Edelblut, was talking a lot about kind of returning local control and vouchers and charter schools and kind of choice. And Senator Hassan's concern was that she did not seem to understand that this is a federal law that she would be enforcing, because she was talking about letting the states and individual school districts make these kinds of decisions. So, it's Senator Hassan has been very tough on her. Senator Al Franken, also a pretty rough exchange with her on assessment and how to determine whether or not schools are performing. But the reality is the Senate Republicans have the votes that they're going to need. So my guess is she will be confirmed. But that the Governor Hassan, Senator Hassan's exchange got a tremendous amount of national visibility. It was all over the cable networks. Good introduction of her to the rest of the country.
I think just if you look at the reaction, and if you've been around New Hampshire for the last few years, a lot of people are familiar with Senator Hassan's political story. I know I keep having to catch myself. But it is a compelling story and one that blends both personal and policy issues. And I think that this was in some ways kind of the perfect way for her to showcase that, because it's something that obviously she's intimately familiar with, what it's like as a parent to have to deal with these issues and the rights and other issues that are at stake, but also is, very clearly trying to be a part of this kind of growing resistance of, Democratic senators who are going to, who are trying in many ways to kind of grandstand and get a lot of attention and get a lot of national spotlight out of these hearings to showcase or try to undermine the nominees that President-elect Trump is putting forth.
Well, that's one thing that's interesting to watch is I was watching that clip and some of Senator Hassan's other questions to people, Tom Price for Health and Human Services. Obviously from her in New Hampshire as governor, it's a different role. She talked a lot about reaching across the aisle. We may have disagreements on principle or policy, but we all work together. And, being part of a legislative body is kind of a different thing. And Democrats, as you say, are sort of mounting this resistance. But, is this at all surprising, or is this just how partisan politics works in Washington? And is this, in fact, the responsibility of a Senate to really put it to nominees, David?
It's certainly their responsibility to make sure they've complied with all the necessary ethics regulations. And largely, as long as they meet the legal requirements, the tradition has been to let the president have the cabinet he wants, absent some kind of unpredicted legal or ethical issues. And so these hearings do largely become an opportunity not only for the individual senators in the minority to make their case nationally as to the policy directions that they see coming, but also, as we heard, to make their presence known on the national stage, possibly as regards some kind of future or political ambitions.
Well, just the rise of social media, I don't know, there's obviously theatrics in all of these hearings from time immemorial, but you look at the degree to which you know, the number of people who are tweeting this and sending me that, and you immediately get whatever kind of hot moment out of these hearings, Dean. I mean, is this you've watched a lot of these hearings
for
years?
Sure, absolutely. And it's I think I've commented many times over the years the extent to which social media has kind of upped the tactical game of the two parties. It really now is it's almost instantaneous and it's moment to moment because you have such immediacy through all the social media applications. So, you know, I think it is true to some extent that the opposition party in the Congress is, the focus at some level is to, hold the feet of the president and the other party to the fire, so to speak. And I think that's what they're going to try to do. You know, you always have the kind of typical language early in the term about how, you know, the Democrats will work with the Republicans where they can and try to block them where they can't. But typically, it sort of very quickly devolves into sort of working as a loyal opposition. So it is a different role for Senator Hassan. She seemed to adapt to it very quickly, seemed to fit right in on there with her Democratic colleagues kind of shifting time back and forth to do the questioning. And so she's off to a running start.
Well, and someone else who's adapting to a new role shortly will be the woman who preceded Senator Hassan in that seat, Senator Kelly Ayotte. She's going to be spending at least the spring semester at Harvard. David, she told your paper she was going to be mostly in New Hampshire, but, you know, a temporary appointment at the Institute of Politics.
It's a great place to go at intervals in your political career. And Jean Shaheen was down there after she lost her first bid for the Senate to John Isonunu. I doubt very much that that's going to be a long-term proposition for Kelly Ayotte. It's probably a holding spot until the next opportunity arises. I don't think we've seen the last of her political ambitions by any stretch.
Well, this certainly is a place you can go where you don't sort of disqualify yourself from heading in any direction, and, you know, a good place to cool your heels.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dave mentioned Jean Shaheen, who was there for a few years, I think, as
she was
executive
director.
Yeah, she was a director. She really kind of set up shop there. And then it was interesting to me. I remember years ago going to an event at the Institute of Politics, and she was there as director. And then literally like a year later, she was running for Senate, and you could see kind of the transition back into the public sphere. And I'm sure we'll see that with Kelly Ayotte as well. It may be more quickly, as a matter of fact.
Okay, I've got an email in from Andrew from Keene. He says, two things. Vouchers for schools seem like they would promote tipping points, especially given the nature of educational system in New Hampshire. Promote them would pull resources from lower supported districts. The other thing he says is, how would Medicaid expansion proceed with the now all but inevitable repeal of the Affordable Care Act? Thank you, Andrew from Keene. You know, sort of big questions. Those have been the implications of school choice in New Hampshire and its educational funding system has been a debate that's going on for some time. It'll be interesting to see what sort of resources Governor Sununu chooses to send that direction in his budget. And Medicaid expansion under the potential repeal of the Affordable Care Act, there are a lot of people who are wondering that, and no clear answers as of yet.
I will say I asked Governor Sununu about that early this week, and he said he's hopeful that in place of the current program, if the ACA is repealed, that there will be block grants coming from the federal government, and then he can set about kind of figuring out how to ensure care for those individuals who are on it. And, you know, we also talked a little bit about the overlap with the opioid crisis and people who need services through Medicaid to deal with that. And, you know, he was very firm in the belief that they could use these block grants in a way that would sort of provide for continuity of care. We'll see. That's it. Block grants are sort of very traditional kind of Republican.
The opioid angle on this is certainly one that you can see the Democrats really seizing upon that as, you know, in their estimation, the best political argument seemingly for the preservation of expanded Medicare. We've had events with both U.S. senators to that effect.
I think also it's worth noting that, you know, depending on the if there's still funding from the federal government for Medicaid expansion, but also how much funding there is. There's a really good article by Allie Morris in the Concord Monitor last weekend, I believe, about the funding that is keeping New Hampshire's Medicaid expansion going right now and the lack of clarity as far as where exactly that's coming from. This seems like a really long time ago, but a year ago, hospitals, insurers struck a deal with the state to provide contributions. No one really knows how much each of those institutions institutions is providing or where that's
coming from.
The hospitals
was a little murkier. Yeah. With insurance, it was some sort of per member for a month.
It was created inherently as a temporary fix. So I think as the plan moves forward, as the program moves forward, that's a big question that the state's going to have to resolve no matter what.
Well, that was something that nobody had a terrific answer for during the gubernatorial campaign. The Democrat, Colin Van Ostern, said, well, we would anticipate that businesses would continue to want to contribute. Sununu would say, well, down the road, the cost of preserving Medicaid expansion as is, could be unsustainable. Obviously, a lot of people are going to be looking at what he puts in his budget. But and depending on what happens in Washington, there may need to be more immediate action. But for now, the state's safe through another year on that front. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. And, obviously speaking of things coming down the pike from Washington, President-elect Trump is going to be President Trump in, about 2 hours and 10 minutes. And there are a lot of people from New Hampshire down there, both people who are supportive of the president and people who are not. And why don't we take a listen to what we heard this morning from Lou Gargiulo of Hampton Falls. He was the Rockingham County co-chair of Trump's campaign. This is what he says he wants to hear out of the president's inaugural speech today.
I'm hoping to hear those steps that he's going to begin to take of turning a lot of the institutions that have been broken or that are not functioning at a level that many people feel as an acceptable level around. I'm hoping to hear what steps he's going to take to stamp out the terrorism issues across the world. I'm also hoping to hear how he is going to approach things like taxation, military, and a whole array of other areas.
All right. That was Lou Gargiulo, Hampton Falls. He's down in Washington for the Trump inauguration. He was one of his Rockingham County co-chairs. Quite a list of things he hopes to hear today, Dean. I mean, in terms of inaugural addresses, and this one's allegedly going to be fairly terse, although we'll see. What do you think we're going to get?
I don't think he's going to hear all of that. As you mentioned, the word is this is going to be about a 20-minute speech, which is not particularly long. Inaugural addresses tend to strike broad themes. He probably will hear something about the desire to shake up existing institutions that are not functioning in the way that they should be. And that was one of the sort of underlying themes of Donald Trump's campaign. So I'm sure we'll hear about that. I'm sure we'll hear about a little bit about his view of America's place in the world and how we're going to deal with terrorism. But you're not likely to hear sort of real detailed programmatic policies at this point. That'll come later in the budget message and then periodically every year with a State of the Union. So it'll be interesting to see. We don't really know what to expect. He'll be on teleprompter. The assumption is he will stay on teleprompter. He hasn't always done that in the past, but this is a pretty high stakes event. So perhaps they've asked him to make sure he stays on teleprompter. So we'll see. I think, if you watch the concert last night at the Lincoln Memorial, you heard him speak a little bit off the cuff. And, I think there will be a unifying message.
There are going to be a lot of people down there who are not necessarily there to hear a unifying message. Sure. Why don't we hear from one of them?
It's a trade-off.
Catherine Carter is a teacher from Lancaster who's organizing a march in Lancaster on Saturday, which is she's not in Washington, but this is a sort of a companion to some of the protesting that's going on down there.
I think we definitely want to give the president-elect a chance. I think that this march is definitely to say, not so much that it's an anti-Trump march, but saying these are the issues that we're concerned about. It's more of a pro-human rights demonstration. So we want our views on minorities and women and veterans to be addressed, and we feel that by doing this march, it's the best way to get those views right out in the forefront.
All right, that was Catherine Carter of Lancaster talking about a sister march that is going to be taking place this weekend here. And so, obviously, there's a lot of protesting going on in Washington. It'll be interesting to see how President Trump handles that. I mean, most of the time inaugural addresses are about sort of reaching out, and that's one thing people are going to wait to hear. I mean, you've been looking at social media this morning, Casey. What's been going on down there?
I think there's, it looks like a mix. I mean, there were a number of protests, as I understand it, last night outside various parties that were taking place among Trump supporters. I would not be surprised to see that continue or perhaps even, you know, escalate, not necessarily in any kind of, you know, destructive way, but just escalate as passions escalate throughout the weekend as the inauguration takes place and the larger protest or march descends on Washington, D.C. And I think it is going to be interesting. It's also interesting to look at kind of, you know, within both, you know, we talk about both sides, but those both sides are not in and of themselves monolithic. There are a lot of varying viewpoints. There's a debate going on right now around the Women's March about the decision to exclude Hillary Clinton's name from the list of women that they're honoring this weekend, which has caused a lot of stir online and within that movement. There are a number of kind of differing factions on the opposite side among Trump supporters or conservatives or Republicans who are just, you know, have varying views as far as what they would like to see and what they're hoping for out of the president. So I think we can expect lots of debate and discussion to continue this weekend and beyond.
Well, that's what makes America great.
Exactly.
We're going to be hearing from President Trump when he's sworn in at noon. You know, quickly, all, what are you going to be focusing on next week, David?
We're going to be looking to see what kind of solution the legislature comes up with for the $65 million deficit in health and human services. And there's going to be some winners and losers on that score for sure.
Casey?
So this is less tied to day-to-day news, but I just want to put a plug in for a project that we're doing. We would like you to send us your questions about New Hampshire. There's a link on our homepage, nhpr.org, and we can help you find some answers to those.
All right, Dean?
Watching the Trump administration settle in and looking for connections between what happens down there and what's going on here in New Hampshire politically. Always interesting with a new president.
All right, and let me put in a plug. Stick with us on NHPR together with NPR. We'll be continuing to cover the inauguration of, you know, in a matter of moments, and then the first 100 days of the White House and some of what goes on at the State House. So do stay tuned. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend, all.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.